Alright, I'm gonna turn the lights on. What time is it? Shit, I'm early. It's like, what, 10 after? Alright, you guys start banging the drums and stuff. We're gonna have an ordeal. Alright, I guess we're gonna have an open mic. I'll just start early. Here, we'll run Warrensey's intro. Just saving you guys from me. Alright, here it is. 1, 2, 3.
From an undisclosed location in the Nevada desert, this is Jennifer Morency of WTF Radio. Welcome to Open Mic Night at the Cormorant Cafe, with your master of ceremonies and master of debates, Rob. My teddy bears were stolen by a...
Hey, welcome to the Cormorant Cafe. As you just heard, I'm Rob. This is open mic. Pretty much no one volunteers. I blame Twitter for the snubs, the continued ungracious snubs. Because I got suspended, and then my backup got suspended. Actually, the first one was also a backup. So two backups got suspended. I would have, you know, really appreciated. You see, like, a while ago I wrote a book. I know, I keep harping on this. But Twitter people helped me. And I'm really annoyed that Twitter, the company, has bots that just automatically suspend you and there's no review and you're just completely gone. Forget your relationships, forget your follower count, forget whatever it is you're using your account for. You know, and I hear rumors that there's some pretty twisted, sick shit going on and people use Twitter for whatever. Hey, I don't know. I'm just bitter, I guess. But at least we have Jennifer Morency and you guys get to listen to me and my bitterness. Alright, so yeah, I think Jennifer's going to tell us something about crab legs. Pretty much the Macmillan sneak preview or whatever it is, it's going to end tonight. So hold on to your butts. Start with the WTF. Here's your Jennifer.
The following segment is a strong political commentary about crime and homicide rates and may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is strongly advised. As many of you will recall, a self-proclaimed liberal created a tweetstorm in December by shitposting the dubious claim that people with EBT cards are buying $40 birthday cake and $60 crab legs at supermarkets. I think that's just another urban legend about poverty, like Ronald Reagan's imaginary welfare queens in Cadillacs. I live in a poor neighborhood where there are only two places to shop. One is the famous dollar store, which doesn't even sell fresh fruit or dairy products, much less crab legs, and the other is a discount supermarket, which is better known for its free Wi-Fi and cheap instant coffee than luxury foods. I don't think very many chronically poor people live in the suburbs next to fancy fish stores and eagle-eyed brunch liberals. In my part of town, you'd have to travel at least 10 miles to find a store that has fresh seafood, and poor people would have to make that trip on the city's dirty and uncomfortable buses, which are often standing room only. Besides, $100 on an EBT card would cover about 3 weeks of food for me. It stretches credulity that poor people would really spend 3 weeks worth of food money on a single luxury meal. But that's the lie that neoliberals want you to believe when they argue for cutting benefits during the pandemic, the myth that poor people are irresponsible with money. The user who claimed to see food stamp abuse also has a bio calling for gun confiscation, a terrible idea even when we're not in the middle of a global plague. With the US gun homicide rate at about 30 people a day, and the number of people dying from COVID-19 at over 3,000 a day as of December 2020, the prospect of sending more cops to go door-to-door visiting people to inspect their guns and seize any that violate the new rules is one of the worst ideas that certain Democrats are fapping over. Around here, it's rare to see a cop wearing a face mask properly, if at all. Even if they didn't kill any citizens directly, the cops enforcing draconian new gun laws would probably kill more people by spreading the virus than the number of people that would have been hypothetically saved by the police forcefully taking away their guns. The usual shitlib response to that is they say they don't really want cops going door to door. In that case, how the hell do they expect those laws to be enforced? Gun control laws aren't going to enforce themselves. Just because a bunch of politicians outlaws a certain group of guns, doesn't mean those guns are going to magically fly away. Somebody is going to have to look for them, and somebody is going to have to take them. And in the USA, that means cops, lots of them, in the middle of a pandemic, when people are running out of money, and are already over-policed. That having been said, in the USA before COVID-19, murder was responsible for only 0.5% of deaths every year. Nowadays, COVID-19 is the leading cause of death in the US. If they really cared about reducing death, the politicians would be funding measures like universal healthcare, screening for diabetes and cancer, and better disease prevention strategies for this pandemic and pandemics to come in the future. The fact that they won't fund universal healthcare, but they're willing to fund a lot more cops, tells you what their real priorities are. They don't want to control the death rate. They just want to control the so-called civilians, which means they want to control you. Thank you for being such a great audience. For more information about these topics, please visit my blog at is.gd/jenmor.
Wow. Well, I guess I asked for it. So, Morency was not going to forward me the read from her political sides, shall we say. And I said, no, do it. Anyway, she's not wrong. So, take that, put that in your pipe and smoke it. All right, I guess I'm going to read my book now. What's left of it. I gotta edit the hell out of this section that you've already heard, and I have to write the other, what did I say, 5 sections. Alright, so Macmillan the Magician, we're on the last complete chapter, which I think is 6, and it just so happens the other day I started writing chapter 7, because I had somebody in LA give me a word, and it was a 3-letter word. It was a very short word. That person gave me a word. I gave that person a page. And you guys, I can give you that page too. Here we go. Okay, so the dog is licking my face, but all right, I'm going to read chapter 6 of Macmillan the Magician. And Adelaide, seriously, it's hard for me to read when you try to put your tongue in my mouth. Okay, I hope you guys can hear this, even though the dog is attacking me. Okay, chapter 6 is called Time Anomaly. Let's see, it's pound, that's a number sign. Then it's 1, ought, ought. Actually, I'm sorry, it's supposed to be chapter 6, Time Anomaly, number 1, double ought. 647 beta, and the super title is Like Running Shoes for Flight, There Are 4 Parts. And I should mention that you don't have to worry. This is actually the last part that I'm going to read in the podcast, but I've actually begun writing the next chapter as of today, actually, which, by the way, for you is last Sunday, but for me, it's earlier today. Adelaide, I really hope that they don't hear you going which is her licking me on my chin. Alright, so here's chapter 6. Okay, so this is part one, Notes from a Bird Hide, and it has A in parentheses. Okay, so something I should have mentioned before about this book is that the purported author has little, like, notes that she writes in parentheses and italics, and this is one of those notes. It says, sometimes when one wants something done, one must do the thing herself. Okay, that's the end of her little note. Alright, here we go. At first, there was the faint, though iridescent, ice-green oval floating, or so it seemed, a few centimeters above the ground. Through it, and with a splash, as though the grass-covered valley floor was a pond, a chunk of rock. Then, for several moments, nothing. And an ancient man, dressed in tight-fitting, wholly synthetic clothes, emerged from an impossibly thin disk of swirling ice-green light. He nearly fell, but caught himself, as one of long practice, with his metal walking cane. Ah, yes. This is a quote. Ah, yes. This must be the place. This must be the one, he muttered, apparently to himself, and then quote, and now to find the magician. In addition to his cane, he carried an old-looking toolbox. From it, he produced a flat polymer and glass oblong, which he then placed carefully within an invisible seam in his tunic. The ancient man put the toolbox on the ground and knelt next to it. He opened the toolbox again. He removed some shiny white gravel, which he littered over the ground. He inspected the inside of the toolbox and, removing a dun-colored vest, quickly searched the pockets. They were empty, and dropped it soundlessly upon the ground. Finally, the newcomer pushed the open toolbox conspicuously away, knocking it over. It slid over the grass and was slightly hard to see in its new location, a few meters away. That'll do, that'll do, that'll do. That last part's a quote. The Chahaki field began its long, slow fade-out, and, at the end of which, he'd be marooned here and now if he survived. From a pocket, he removed a yellow-covered notebook and, with agility, fondled it, touching and sliding his dexterous fingers over page after page. He then removed from upon his person a machine. Hi, Adelaide. My goodness, are you done looking out the windows at the squirrels? Okay, so we have Adelaide. You like to interrupt a reading, Eddie. Alright, so from a pocket he removed a yellow-covered notebook and, with agility, fondled it, touching and sliding his dexterous fingers over page after page. He then removed from upon his person a machine with which he fidgeted while he read. Finally, apparently reluctantly, he put this machine to his lips and blew on it. Yes, he muttered. 1886. This is quoted. There was a grave finality to the words. He returned the machine to its pocket, and from another pocket he removed an antique, six-shot revolver. He fumbled in his leggings and produced a bullet, then five more, and placed them into the weapon. This is also a quote. Only one shot, and all is lost if... ... end quote. He didn't finish the thought. He needed to locate his target. And this is another one of her notes. I watched him walk away at a pretty fast pace. That's the end of part one. Okay, this is Macmillan, the magician. Where are we at anyway here? Chapter 6, part 2, which is called, this is Report from Head Research Coordinator Evans's Office. Okay, I hope I didn't just screw up the microphone by doing that. Alright, so this is one of her notes. In a little italicized parenthetical remark, she says, possibly not a final draft. Bear in mind, I had to translate this from another syntactically inferior language. And then end her note. Alright. Already in character, the man, and now, this is like what Evans calls the person who stepped through that thing. So it's all caps, and there's, I mean, I should have hyphenated it, but so he's, whenever he says the old man who tried to kill Macmillan, okay, in the book, every word except the word two is capitalized. Okay, already in character, the old man who tried to kill Macmillan crossed the short span from the dusty utility building over the crunchy snow-white gravel to a squat, standalone structure I'll call the physics lab. In his left hand, he carried a heavy antique toolbox. See attached evidence sheet. Now, some of these things he has in bold because they are apparently in the attached evidence sheet. So, in that paragraph, the words heavy antique toolbox were in bold, so we probably have the toolbox. And so he's got a pictures to prove it. All right, sorry. Next paragraph. The physics lab, little more than a shed really, had a low ceiling and a few small windows. It was dark. The old man who tried to kill Macmillan slapped a switch by the door. The resulting artificial light filled every crevice and corner. Evidence obtained by this office indicates he may have set down his toolbox. Apparently devoted to a single project, the physics lab was tidy and modern. As the single room space became illuminated, computing and communications equipment booted, beeping and blinking their good mornings. A single low-frequency hum indicated the present technological awakening was complete. All the lights were green or blinking green, and the time had come. The device, he put capital the and capital device. The device, a prototype and first of its kind, waited, ready for the maiden voyage. This mechanically induced and homicidal Chahaki event would also be a world's first. Unfortunately, the present account accepted, history does not reflect... Alright, he continues. The old man who tried to kill Macmillan rapidly tapped several keys, authorizing his presence and granting access. After initiating the event, the old man edited a line in the computer's log. That line, in the edited version, portrayed his work as a non-active test of the experimental hardware. And he also removed two lines. Professor Gray keyed in 1886. Enter. He typed 02, enter. He typed 01, enter. He examined the log on another terminal, then switched its monitor off. The coordinates, though, must have been tricky. An examination of all university computers' logs over the past 5 years reveals he earlier used an open terminal in a student writing center to examine astrophysics data. I'm not speaking as an expert, but there is no good enough when one is traveling a century and a half into the past. The most obvious part of the device, and he did that capital thing again, the composite ring, an oval, taller and wider than a large man, locked with a soft snap. Then a glowy blue-green interference pattern, think visual static, white noise, filled the aperture. Gray removed a beige egg timer, he has that in bold, from the toolbox. He fiddled with it. See attached evidence sheet. Still not completely sure of his outfit, and a bit leery of this use of the technology, the old man who tried to kill Macmillan lifted his toolbox, took a breath, and a last glance at a full-size mirror he'd placed against the wall sometime earlier, and stepped up to the composite ring. The egg timer went ding. Professor Gray stepped into the first human-created chalky field and out into the Mojave Desert, February 1st, 1886, at 1500 hours. The sun almost blinded him. He closed his eyes tightly and removed a small, he's got it bold, and removed a small notepad from a hidden pocket, see attached evidence sheet. Professor Gray turned away from the sun and consulted his notes. Somehow he was aware of the campfire story. He has that in bold. And you're familiar with the campfire story if you've been listening to this podcast. See attached evidence sheet. Somehow he's aware of other things, stories I myself am not privy to. And then here's some. So there's a note within a note. The purported author lady is saying, "A shame, Officer Evans, a damn shame." And then end her note. Which gave him a bead on McMillan's location in early February 1886. Only a few months after his nearly fatal arrival. See also, and then these are quoted document titles, McMillan First Contact and McMillan A Beginner's History. Okay, so Evans continues. The notebook was found. The toolbox, empty naturally, was found. Several pieces of stark white granite were found. And McMillan recorded via his escape pod's AI computer the encounter. Professor Gray survived and apparently returned to his normal schedule and never tried again. These are also quoted document titles. A Gray interview, Corey Flynn complete, and its addenda. The old man who tried to kill McMillan ended the non-active equipment test and then, for all intents and purposes, completely forgot everything? The memo pad, of course, was an artifact out of time, and the so-called antique toolbox with Kruth and Sons /1921 had been embossed under the latch. Sorry, I was just trying to figure out if I wrote that sentence wrong or read it wrong. Our people spent weeks cleaning all that shit up. Weeks. Dressed as local police from the era, Officer Corey and Sergeant Flynn had a short interview with this Professor Gray 2 years to the day after his little vacation. Again, see Gray interview, Corey Flynn complete, and its addenda. As you'll remember, they made up a dramatic story of a rape on campus. The victim, having been tied, she said, inside a dusty utility building. They also told him she had described the gravel and that there was someone else, a witness, maybe dressed in so-called Old West attire, carrying a toolbox. They showed him server logs indicating his credentials had been used to access a physics lab and begin some kind of equipment test. Professor Gray confirmed these were his account access credentials, but insisted that, being a German lit professor, he had no business testing physics equipment. Note as well, he claimed he didn't know where to find the lab. This is where our man produced, admittedly grainy, outdoor security video of the old man who tried to kill McMillan, played on Corey's period mock-up laptop. The people known as Flynn and Corey, it just says Flynn and Corey but has their names in quotes, went so far as to insinuate the good professor was either the rapist himself or he was covering for someone. Unfortunately, Gray panicked and took out his phone. He became frantic. He was jabbering and looking up various individuals to attest to his whereabouts and character. He looked up the head of the physics department, the work-study boss from the uni's IT department, and his own department head. Before he was able to call any of these people, it just says Corey and Flynn in quotes. Corey and Flynn relented and got the fuck out of there. Concerned, rightly, they themselves were introducing butterflies into the timeline. He's going to have quoted titles. See field handbook. See interrogation methods. See undercover in another time? Case study. I, however, was able to clear them, though, because my own team found only a brief memo on a private lawyer's blotter about a possible consultation. The original page had been crumpled up and tossed in the bin, and an entry in Gray's wife's diary indicating he had, quote, possibly work-related, end quote, stress-induced ED that night after she had gone to some lengths to initiate an intimate encounter following a romantic evening on their upstairs patio watching a meteor shower. See attached evidence sheet. The following questions remain unanswered, but this officer and this office consider the matter closed pending an astounding amount of luck. And then he has the three questions listed like this. Did the old man work alone? And the next one. If the criminal wasn't the good professor, who was it and why impersonate him? And the third one. Why did the old man want Macmillan dead? That's the end of part two. Okay, this is Macmillan the Magician, chapter, what are we on, are we still, what is going on, heck, I have to make these separate because the machine is retarded. I have to make these separate because they get too long, and if I make a mistake, I have to redo it. Alright, so this is chapter 6, and we've already read parts 1 and 2. So this is part 3. Okay, Macmillan the Magician, chapter 6, part 3. Notes from a bird hide, part B. And then, so she has one of her little notes that says, 4 days after, she put one, but she means the other notes from a bird hide thing. Okay, so 4 days have passed. She's watching from where she is. Now, normally she would have one of her, I'm saying this because you're probably not listening to these back to back. If you were listening to these back to back, this would be obvious. She has an agent that she sends, whatever. But in this case, she claims she's doing the observation herself. So she's been kind of hanging out and keeping notes. All right. The newcomer returned to the barely visible chalky field. He appeared out of breath. He looked uncertainly behind himself. He took out his revolver and fired a shot in the air. Merlin appeared as if from nowhere. He and his people can move quite fast if they decide to, and confronted the old man. He yanked the cane away, and the newcomer straightened up as though he wasn't an old man after all. And then she has one of her notes that says, I was not expecting this. The old man, and now she put old man in quotes, the old man moved his right arm as if to backhand Merlin. With that, Merlin, in an abrupt gesture that may be mistaken for sudden frustration, struck out at the other man. The old man stepped back toward the nearly gone, though still slightly shimmering green light. He moved a hand to defend himself, once a portion of his bare wrist came ever so slightly, ever so briefly, into contact with the side of Merlin's bare hand. A warm feeling overcame... She's using Evans's term. The old man who tried to kill Macmillan, she put it in italics. As he stumbled backwards, vanishing into the collapsing portal, his mission failed. That's the end of part 3. Okay, Macmillan the Magician, chapter 6, part 4. It says this is called coda, or the so a coda, the way I use it, is sort of like an afterthought or the ending. It says coda, or quote, R.I.P. Professor Gray Jr., we hardly knew yet, end quote. Alright, so here we go. So now she's kind of dropping the facade a little, and here's her little note says, so that's all the information, but consider a slightly different narrative, if I may indulge the reader. She didn't even put the note in parentheses. Anyway, the intentionally botched attempt on Merlin's life barely fazed him. He recounted it to the escape pod. The escape pod confirmed a suspected Chahaki event in the vicinity. The massometer readings must have been interesting. There was no discussion of time travel, most likely because Merlin didn't imagine anything like that was possible. Note to reader, a Chahaki field wouldn't help Merlin, for example, return to his galaxy, even if the distances involved weren't too great. The calculations, given all the moving parts of both galaxies and local systems, would make it technologically nearly impossible, in case you were thinking he'd express some level of interest in the thing. Besides, the escape pod had warned him that they were possible and even likely. And then, parentheses for Mark, she says, however, there was still the matter of the missing crewman, spy, policeman, adversary, whatever that werewolf guy. Alright, so you've read the classified Time Police, quote, Office of Case Review file entitled, I'm not making this up either. Now, that's her talking, not me talking. So you've read the classified exclamation mark. Time Police, quote, Office of Case Review, end quote, file entitled, I'm not making this up either, quote, The Old Man Who Tried to Kill McMillan, end quote, which, dare I say, makes the culprit quite obvious to anyone with two brain cells to rub together. He or she, dot, 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 now she's going to have a bulleted list. So this is the writer of this McMillan book's bulleted list of who she thinks the old man who went through the time portal was. So the first bullet point says, he or she is someone with something against Professor Gray's now non-existent child or grandchild, great-grandchild, or anyway, someone in Professor Gray's child's line. And the next bullet point, this person has access to Professor Gray's wife's diary from the original timeline, most likely outlining a romantic evening, stargazing, and then an additional note sometime nine or however long months later, linking that night to their child's conception. The next bullet point, this person is aware of more than one odd or out of place but true story linking our Andromedan in Southern California in the 19th century, and one of those stories contains exact time and location data. She puts note, I am not myself aware of any story like this, you know, besides this novel. The next bullet point, so the fourth bullet point says, this person has access / technology / wherewithal to manipulate computers from his or her own past. I'm estimating at least 30 years, but upwards of 200 years. She put an exclamation mark in parentheses after 200. The next bullet point, the next last bullet point, this person is familiar with Chahaki fields and temporal events. And the final bullet point, this person probably considers the Time Police easily manipulated. She puts note, I think I have presented this person's case clearly enough. Alright, so now we're not doing the bullet list anymore. She says, Chahaki fields were quote-unquote officially, per historic record, discovered / invented some 200 years after Professor Gray's encounter with the fake local cops Corey and Flynn. Chahaki fields make instantaneous travel of relatively small objects over large distances possible. They have nothing at all to do with time travel. The Time Police saying otherwise is like saying running shoes can be used for flight. Of course, like Officer Evans, I am not speaking as an expert on the subject. How twisted does a relationship, this is her talking, not me, by the way. How twisted does a relationship have to become for one party to figure out how to make the other party's distant ancestors cease to exist? Not just killed, no, erased from all existence. And taking out a whole branch of the family tree in the process. She puts a parenthesis note. But I'm probably wrong. Some weird old dude just wanted to kill my grandpa. And she says, a final note. It seems clear that Officer Evans is unaware of most of Merlin's abilities. And that, my friends, is the end of chapter 6, and we have caught up to where the narrative needed more research. And as of this morning, I can assure you that I am at work on the first part of chapter 7, which involves an alien, another alien from space, but not from another galaxy, coming through into McMillan's little valley, and then we get to deal with that. All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed it. Okay, just a little sneak peek preview of chapter 4, and there might be some phone noises, I'm sorry. Oh, and a lot of what I'm going to read is going to change, and it's only one page, so I'm going to read it here anyway, just because I don't want to have to save the whole, I don't want to have to finish the whole chapter in order to read it, and This preview for the Macmillan book wasn't supposed to encompass the whole thing anyway. So this should be, this reading of the relatively raw second draft of this, it's not even the whole first part. It's like the first page of part one of chapter 7. But also, I needed help with a couple of the words on this page, so like actually asking some other human because I couldn't think of the right word to use. And for what it's worth, one of those words is the French word for stop. And even then, it's probably still wrong. So I have that particular person trying to find me another word. And the other word, and she found this one instantaneously. I asked her for a word for like a small monster. And I described the situation pretty as well as I could. I tried to describe the monster, even though in the book it's not going to be described very well. And she, first try, first word, she said imp. And I was like, well, I have to check for some cultural relevancy. If the word is too loaded, then it either makes it more perfect or it makes it a really terrible word because then I have to be aware of the folklore or whatever behind it. So, for example, insinuating that Tisman is Icarus, the wax wings flew too close to the sun. See, I have to know the story of Icarus to insinuate that way. Otherwise, you know, I guess it could just be that's the random name that someone slapped on the character. Like, this character's name is Macmillan, but it's not. Or it's Merlin, but it's not. But those words have meanings in our culture. Anyway, it turns out the word imp is so perfect. So perfect. And I told her that. So, but anyway, here we go. Chapter 7, part 1. So, chapter 7 is called A False Stop. And the super title is An Imp's Tale. And part 1 is The Devil's Spawn. Okay, now, this is one of the fake author's little notes, and this is a pretty long one. It says, note, events described are true per attached resources. Some liberties, though, have been taken concerning the small alien's thoughts. My agent attempted to use the demon, but unfortunately this resulted in the imp's immediate death and a permanent and irreparable malfunction in the device every time. So, so, they only have one of this device, which, well, you guys should buy my book. You'll know what that is. And there's only the one imp. So for her to insinuate that they did it multiple times means that she either ran the experiment versus parallel versions of the universe, or she traveled in time, or she somehow replicated the creature. But anyway, she's trying to use some kind of a machine to read his thoughts so that she doesn't have to make up a fiction of his thoughts. And she's saying it didn't work. So if she talks about whatever the thoughts, there you are. All right. So the devil spawn shook its head with confusion and frustration. This was a foeret. It had read about them, but until this moment, never believed they were real. At least the air here was breathable and the temp tolerable. It looked around, pure desolation, though perhaps desolation is too strong. The place was not a void or a battle aftermath. This is more untamed? It gave the matter another moment's thought. Maybe this place, this planet, has no development, neither fostering its own intelligent beings nor colonized by others. The imp rubbed his hands together greedily. It was an innocent, virgin world, and as far as this devil was concerned, it was all his. Alright, well, there you are. That's the first... My goodness, that's the first page of the first part of the next chapter. So, you get to see what some random alien creature who thinks he's alone on the planet does. Alright. So that should close our preview of the book. And maybe if I keep writing, there will be a completed book sometime. We're at, right, I don't know, maybe 50 pages. And the other novel was 300. It doesn't matter. It's relative. I'm using the same types of fonts. So it doesn't, I don't have to tell you the word count. It's just that if we're at page 50 or whatever of a book that's going to be 300 pages, you see. All right. All right, well, 40-something, I guess, minutes. And so we can finish our... We don't have to read from the book that's not published anymore since it's done now. And let me see. I should thank you for listening. Thank you for contributing, which no one did, so screw you for not contributing. And as Adelaide, please... Oh, that's the good girl you are. My little co-host... Alright, thank you for the actual co-host, Jennifer Morrissey, for the introduction, and for the, good political, rant, essay, I don't know, comedy bit. Thank you for her, thank you for you guys listening and subscribing, and I don't know, do people leave ratings? Is it even possible? Alright, anyway, this is also a minute long. Please, thank you. Good night.
I am reality's whore!
This place is dangerous.